the church's music from the second century.
Shepherd of tender youth, guiding in love and truth.
The sixth century. The 12th century.
O come, O come, Emmanuel.
The 16th century.
Lord, keep us steadfast in your word. Help us to fight this evil.
The 21st century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
It's always a little risky attempting to speak for dead men, although some of them have left such a legacy, such a solid and well-worn footprint, especially in the church, that it's a little easier, it's a little safer to say what they would do today. One of those who have left such a footprint in the church today, although you may not know it, is J.S. Bach, who is known to the world as a great classical musician, peripherally as perhaps a church musician, and sad to say, to much of the church as, well, rather unknown except for the occasional organ prelude or little piece that you might hear, special performance piece you might hear. What can the 21st century church learn from the life and work of J.S. Bach, apart from good music appreciation? Joining us to answer that question on this Tuesday afternoon, September the 25th, Dr. Paul Grimm. He's Associate Professor of Pastoral Ministry and Missions and Dean of the Chapel at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of an article in the latest Concordia Theological Quarterly titled, What Would Bach Do Today? Dr. Grimm, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Good to talk to you again.
Other than that occasional organ prelude or performance piece, what's left of J.S. Bach in the church today?
Well, I think what was behind the article that I wrote is really to point out that there's an attitude that Bach has bequeathed to us that is perhaps most important. The reality is not a lot of his music is played in most of our congregations. As you say, the occasional organ prelude does happen. Occasionally cantatas, his larger choral pieces that he wrote. But I think more so it's the attitude that he conveyed in his own time, which he displayed with his own work and which has been handed down in the church. And it really didn't even start with Bach, but he certainly inherited it from previous church musicians of generations that preceded him. And that attitude is one that, how to summarize easily, it takes the rich treasure that has been handed down into the church and adds to it so that future generations, well, first of all, that the Word of God can be proclaimed in music in his own time, but that in the future generations it can be continued to be proclaimed as the next generation takes what they receive, add to it, carry it on, and that just continues down to the present age.
Well, that raises an interesting question because church music today, the best of it seems to retain that attitude for now and for the ages. But the worst of it seems to be, you know, only what's popular and selling or playing in the top 40 on Christian radio stations, pop music radio stations. Bach has this attitude. What do you believe from what you have learned of him that he was consciously composing and setting the text of Holy Scripture to music for the ages, for us today?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, I'm not sure if we can say that for sure. He certainly took his calling as, you know, church musicians in various locations, especially the 27 years he spent in Leipzig, the last 27 years of his life. I mean, he took that calling and the work he was called to do there very seriously. And he really was working for that time and place. But, I mean, perhaps and to some degree he also recognized that, you know, the great gifts he had been given were something that would certainly carry on after him as well. To what degree, there's no way he could have known. You know, and in fact, as often happens is the case with some of the great, you know, artists of various times, you know, with their passing, sort of a generation or a whole era passes, and with Bach, too, I mean, he's kind of forgotten for a half century, three quarters of a century, until there was a revival in the 19th century And that has led to new revivals in the 20th century and a greater and greater appreciation for the genius that was behind his work.
Talk about Bach's world. How would you describe it?
Well, it's lots of interesting confluences, I think, that came together with Bach. He, as I mentioned, you know, he was not university trained. He did not have a university degree, yet he worked in a town, Leipzig, for the last 27 years of his life that had a very prestigious university, and he rubbed shoulders, undoubtedly, with many of the professors at that university on numerous occasions and had to carry his own weight in terms of his knowledge. He was certainly well-read in various disciplines, in theology particularly. We have, you know, the contents of his library at the time of his death, which may have already been picked over by some before the contents were recorded, but it indicates that he had a fair number of significant theological collections, including Luther's works and others, dogmaticians from the 17th century. He Leipzig was very significant, sort of as a crossroads for all kinds of things happening in Europe in the 18th century, and most significant for Leipzig were the book fairs that they had three times a year. His immediate duty was to write music for those festivals. There would be special services and special even civic events, and he had to write music that would be sung or performed at those events. But as significantly was the fact that he also was able to keep up with what was going on in the world as publishers from all over the place came to sell their wares. We know, for example, that Bach just had an extensive collection of music by other composers that he had in his own possession that he obviously studied, and that in many cases he takes some of the music of these other composers and he will actually sort of recast them, adding additional voice parts to the music to make them better, which, you know, only somebody like Bach could really do. And that wasn't seen as being an insult in those days or as a copyright infringement, but was in more cases probably understood as a compliment to take someone else's music and to make it better, to say, oh, I like what's here, and I'm going to actually, you know, take my art and craft and add to it as well. I mean, it was a very progressive thinking attitude in many ways in terms of all these different influences that were sort of, you know, swirling probably around in his head and trying to bring them all together into this wonderful synthesis with the music that he wrote.
So much of the issue today has to do with the instrumentation of the church's music. How would you describe Bach's, both his attitude and his practice when it came to different instruments and even at his time and shortly thereafter, brand new ones?
Right. Well, as I mentioned in the article, he certainly makes use of the traditional instrumentation that had been in long-standing use in the church. And, you know, the organ, of course, and his wonderful compositions for that instrument that it really sort of bring to the very pinnacle the writing styles of the previous generations as music had been developing. But, you know, other instruments, in addition to strings, it's especially probably in the woodwind categories that he is a little more adventuresome and actually is writing, you know, music for new instruments that are being developed at that time, different versions of the oboe and the contrabassoon, a very low-based bassoon. He's one of the first to experiment with some of these instruments, or at least the first that we're aware of with any significant music that survives the composer. And so, you know, he wasn't afraid to venture out. He had a chance to play one of the earliest models of a piano, which, you know, to that point it was organ or harpsichord or the clavichord, which is even a smaller, more quiet version of a harpsichord that was the standard keyboard instrument. But he had a chance to study pianos in the last 10 years or so of his life. And in fact, offered all kinds of suggestions to the builder for how to do it better. And Zilbermann, who was this builder, actually didn't do any more pianos, didn't make any more for about a decade as he perfected the technique of the instrument, much along the lines probably of what Bach had suggested. And it wasn't really until after Bach's death that the piano then truly comes to the fore as a significant instrument, certainly replacing the organ and harpsichord as the chief keyboard instrument in instrumentation for orchestral music. And in fact, Bach's one of his sons, Johann Christoph, was one of the first composers of piano concertos, quote unquote, taking some concepts of the model Bach was doing in some of his keyboard concertos, but then moving into the piano and beginning that development into a new style that eventually led to Mozart and eventually to Beethoven, etc.
Well, melding what you talked about at the beginning here with only a few minutes before our first break with your picture of kind of the musical world where Bach found himself, this attitude that you spoke of at the beginning, where he is endeavoring to employ the best of his day, the best of his personal talents toward the proclamation of God's word for the church. How do you bring those together to kind of put a summary on Bach in his day, how he was doing it in his day?
Well, Bach even gives a little hint himself in one of his writings. He talked about developing a well-regulated church music, which he felt was essential for the church to be doing her work best in the best possible way. And it really wasn't until he got to Leipzig that he felt he had all the forces in place to make that happen. And you see this flurry of activity at that point that is just unprecedented. Basically, for the first 3 years of his tenure, he writes a new cantata every week, which would, you know, you're looking at a piece of music that can be anywhere from 20 to 30 or so minutes long in multiple movements with different instrumentation. And the amazing thing is, as scholars have studied those cantata series, of which we have a good portion of the cantatas, but not all of them, some have been lost, you get this sense that it's as though the sky's the limit in terms of being able to take text and to be able to set them in a way that is always drawing you into the text, with using every imaginable music device in his repertoire to help to accentuate the text and to allow that text to really shine forth.
Dr. Paul Grimm is our guest. We're answering the question, what can the 21st century church learn from the life of and the work of J.S. Bach? When we come back, we'll have 10 more minutes with Dr. Grimm.
How would you like to win a 4-CD set of 45 Reformation hymns? It's titled Heirs of the Reformation, Treasures of the Singing Church. Now here is how you enter this contest. First, like the Facebook fan page for Lutheran Public Radio, Sacred Music for the World, facebook.com/Lutheran Public Radio. Second, post an invitation for your Facebook friends to listen to Lutheran Public Radio. And third, send the text of your Facebook post and the number of your Facebook friends to contest@issuesetc.org. We'll give away this 4-CD set, Heirs of the Reformation, to the contestant with the best Facebook post and to the contestant with the most number of Facebook friends. We'll announce the winner on Monday, October the 1st. Participate in a Facebook contest for Lutheran Public Radio during the month of September.
Luther had Wartburg. We have Collinsville. You're listening to Issues Etc.
In a world awash with all sorts of information, opinions, and ideas, there is still a place where God's Word is the central and only focus. Messiah Lutheran Church, 801 North Madison, Lebanon, Illinois. At 9 o'clock on Sunday mornings, God's people gather there to listen to Him. There you will find His words of law and gospel, and of course, our Lord's Holy Supper. Bible classes focus on the Bible and the Lutheran confessions. Come, listen, believe, and live, and check out our website at messiahlebanon.org.
Does your church need a backup organist? The virtual organist service from Church Music Solutions is the next best thing to an on-site organist. Send us your musical choices, including liturgy and hymns. We'll assemble your service and send it to an iPad that controls your church's organ on Sunday. The result is genuine organ leadership on your instrument with your selections when you need it. See our videos on YouTube or visit our website at churchmusicsolutions.com.
Thank you.
That's the Bach Cantata for the 17th Sunday after Trinity this coming Sunday. Ach, lieben Christen, seid getrost. Oh, dear Christians, be reassured. By the way, you can listen to this cantata in its entirety Sunday afternoon at 1 Central on Lutheran Public Radio. That's lutheranpublicradio.org. Absolutely free. These weekly Bach cantatas, appropriate to the Sunday, are brought to you uninterrupted courtesy of Church Music Solutions, producer of The Virtual Organist, a program that plays liturgy, service music, and hymns using your organ. When you can't find an organist, check out The Virtual Organist at churchmusicsolutions.com. We're talking about what the 21st century church can learn from the life and work of J.S. Bach. Dr. Paul Grimm is our guest. Dr. Grimm, let's talk about the musical world today. How would you describe it from the viewpoint of both a musician and a theologian? How would you... It's hard to describe as the musical world of Bach's day, but give it a stab.
Yeah, okay. To do that, I'm going to give just a very brief history, which I think can be helpful. As I mentioned, you know, what Bach was about was not something new in a sense, but was, you know, can be demonstrated in Lutheran composers, and I'll just leave it in the Lutheran world, prior to his time. And what you have is this sense that in every generation, the composers took the rich heritage that had been handed down, but they added to it. And that included adding to it new styles. I mean, musical styles changed over the course of the 16th, 17th, 18th centuries. And the composers that really, you know, played a great role in that development of Lutheran music were some of them, you know, in the forefront of musical leadership in Europe in the 18th century, 17th century. And so what they did was that they would take that rich tradition and they would sort of bring in the new techniques and marry them with the old. It wasn't that they simply wiped out what had been done in the past and said, now we do it all new. But they took from the past, they added to it, made something even better. And it was almost like the church's culture being handed on from generation to generation, sort of subsuming the newest stuff into it and just continuing to adapt you know, as the Borg in Star Trek, they talk about the Borg assimilating. In a sense, they were assimilating all these new things, and that kind of continued pretty much down through the ages. You lose a little bit of that after Bach's death, when the church sort of no longer becomes the center of the universe when it comes to the musical world, because it sort of moved from the church as one of the main patrons of the music into the realm of first some princes and courts, but then later on, just, you know, musicians became freelancers, and they're just doing their own thing, and the concert hall takes center stage. But the church still had that sense of sort of taking away from the past and adding to it, and that continued right into the 20th century. There was even in Germany, for example, among Lutheran composers in the early 20th century, sort of this renaissance of taking from the past the old things and giving them a new sense and of direction, and sort of just taking old concepts and new sounds attached to those. But, you know, in the later 20th century, something happened, and we'll talk about it in this country in particular. You sort of have a rise of a new culture, and that culture is the pop culture. I mean, we had this art culture, this art music culture that had been handed off for generations. You also have kind of a folk culture that always subsisted at the same time, where just the singing of very simple things that people learned, and you know, that was a part of tradition, too. But pop music shows up in the late 20th century, and that really does have a different effect. I mean, pop culture is connected to this, of course. And I like to talk about the fact that it probably kind of gets its start with the rise of the transistor radio in the early 1960s, the ability for people to take their music with them where they go, teenagers, to the beach, to the park, with their transistor radio. Other technological advances that take place include the development of photocopiers, and then computers that can do nice computer-generated church bulletins, which are like mini hymnals every week being published at this point. Screens that, you know, you have projectors that can put these things on the screen. I mean, all these things together have sort of changed our the way we think about how church music is done. And what you started to get was this subset of people saying, well, I want my kind of music in church, the kind of music I listen to on my transistor radio, now in my car radio, and on my iPod with a playlist of the music I like to listen to. And so it really sort of changed an expectation to some degree. And what I think happened then also was that it was at the same time that the pop culture really didn't really have an interest in the past at all. It was interested in the present. And so, you know, what the church had to offer from generations and centuries of experience really was of no interest as you start to see, instead developing this new musical language of what we now know as a multi-billion-dollar industry, the contemporary Christian music industry, centered in Nashville, Tennessee, which pumps out, you know, just recording after recording after recording, and you know, and songbook after songbook every year. And it's a multi-billion-dollar industry that has a powerful influence on the church. As people hear this music day in and day out on their radios, and just kind of naturally came to think that that's what church music should be like, you know, on Sunday morning as well. It left composers who had been trained in the traditional styles and had been, you know, heirs of that rich tradition kind of out in left field with no place to go, in a sense. They really didn't find the ability to take that pop culture and try to amalgamate that into the larger tradition as we had done in past generations, and you sort of get this bifurcation. Either you do it this way or you do it this way, the new way or the old way.
Now, one of the points that you make, and I don't think it's necessarily a minor point, but it does help kind of orient our perspective, is that it's often assumed that quote-unquote classical music or serious music is not enjoyed by the populace, and you say that's just not true. Well, how can you say that?
Yeah, it's a fun little thing. Studies will show that only 2% of people listen to classical music. So, you know, the argument's made, why would you want to use classical music in church if only 2% of the people regularly listen to that? That's not their heart language, and so they're not going to be interested in it. You know, the church primarily, first of all, is not about classical music. And the last thing I want to give the impression is that, you know, you come to church on Sunday morning, you should expect to hear a concert, quote-unquote. Sometimes church musicians shoot themselves and others in the feet by doing that. Their Sunday morning offering becomes this grand performance that really draws attention to themselves and how good they are, as opposed to pointing to Christ and the gospel. But the argument's flawed in another sense, from the other direction. Namely, you know, when you talk about classical music, what you really are talking about is artfully composed music, music that's been composed by composers who really do know what they're doing. They know their craft, and they work to hone their craft and to do it well. And the place where, you know, artfully composed music really intersects with the public in a very dramatic way on a regular basis is especially in the film industry. The soundtracks that you find behind, I mean, all of your favorite movies, even the ones that aren't such favorites, I mean, that music is, by and large, quite artfully composed. And it struck me a number of years ago. I was actually attending a Broadway musical, On the Town, by the music is by Leonard Bernstein, famous composer and mostly conductor in the late 20th century. And at one point in the musical, I'm suddenly listening, not really following the story anymore, but just listening to music and amazed at the technical complexity of it. I mean, the things he was doing with you know, things that I learned in music theory in college. For the average person in that room, they don't know those techniques that he was using, but it contributed to the full experience of, you know, in a sense, delivering the text, delivering the story that was a part of that musical for our consumption. And that really is the case for any movie of any quality that you listen to. If the music has had any effort put into it at all, it's going to be artfully composed music that helps to deliver the story. And it does so in a very, very powerful way. And I think the example I give in the article is a piece of music that's actually from the art world that was used in the film. And it was the movie Platoon, which is a pretty gut-wrenching, raw look at the Vietnam War and much of the controversy behind that war. And at that one point toward the end where there's this unfortunate slaughtering of civilians and soldiers on the battlefield, and our helicopters swoop in to, you know, get the wounded out, but they can't get them all, as some are left to be slaughtered still by the enemy. The music from Samuel Barber's Adagio for Strings is played, which Barber wrote decades before, long before the war. But this music is just, you know, it tears at your gut when you listen to it. It's because of a musical technique, suspensions, that just keep pushing and driving the music forward. And, you know, at that point in the movie, you know, all conversation stops, and it's just this music that takes over and then slowly fades in the background as the helicopters have to, you know, bug out and get out of there. But it just demonstrates a power, and it's the kind of music people are used to listening to all the time. It's just that they don't think of it as classical music. And it's not that we would use those soundtracks in church, because they're designed for a particular purpose, and it's not to deliver, you know, the gospel, but to deliver the storyline of a particular movie. But yet, to just make the argument that, well, music, classical music is not part of our repertoire, so to speak, of our listening pleasure, is not an accurate statement.
Can you stay with us through the next hour for a few minutes, Dr. Grimm?
For a few minutes, sure.
All right. Real quickly, before we take our next break, I'll save my question for the other side of the break. We're going to be talking with Dr. Paul Grimm for the next 10 minutes of the program. But we need to get into the text, because what was so important, even for a composer, not an author or a poet, but a composer like J.S. Bach, was the text. The text drove forward his music. It was not only the inspiration for his music in that kind of general musical sense, but it was in fact the whole reason he was writing much of his music for the church. And his cantatas, of course, are a great example of that. We will talk about the text for J.S. Bach and the text today, and how important it still is for the church that the text be the primary thing and the music be and remain the vehicle. Dr. Paul Grimm is our guest. He's Associate Professor of Pastoral Ministry and Missions and Dean of the Chapel at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of an article in the latest Concordia Theological Quarterly titled, What Would Bach Do Today? When we come back, your questions and your comments in hour two after we conclude our conversation with Dr. Paul Grimm, Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse will join us from the Ruth Institute, talk about Plan B being made available to students at 13 New York high schools, and there's a California bill that would allow children to have not one, not two, but three, oddly enough, three parents. Then Pastor Tom Baker will join us to talk about the fall of Jericho in Joshua chapter 6. That's hour two of Issues, Etc. Straight ahead, I'm Todd Wilkin. Stay tuned.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Logia, a journal of Lutheran theology, is a quarterly publication for the Confessional Lutheran, and they have a special 20th anniversary CD. This CD contains every issue of Logia for the last 20 years. It's a PDF file with search capabilities and bookmarks. This special anniversary CD is an excellent addition to your theological library. You can pre-order it for just $40. That's 50 cents per issue. Find out more at logia.org, logia.org.
Hi, this is Jonathan Collin from France.
Thanks to God's gift of the Internet, people are listening to Issues, Etc. around the world.
First, I would like to say thank you very much for your program. It very much ministers to those of us who are outside the comforts and the luxuries of having a confessional Lutheran congregation nearby. Thank you very much for this great resource.
Listen to what you want, when you want, wherever you are. IssuesETC.org.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. A few more minutes here in the second hour of Issues, Etc. with Dr. Paul Grimm. We're answering the question, what can the 21st century church learn from the life and work of J.S. Bach? Our call-in number 1-877-623-6943. Our in-studio email address, talkback@issuesetc.org, and our Twitter address, @issuesetc. A little bit later, we'll be talking with Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse about Plan B available to students at 13 New York high schools. And then Pastor Tom Baker will join us to talk about the fall of Jericho in Joshua chapter 6. Dr. Grimm, let's talk about the text, because even though he did not write texts, but music, the text was very important to Bach. How would you describe the kind of the contrast between the texts of Bach and the texts of church music today?
Well, certainly with Bach's music, it is the Lutheran chorale that stands at the center, or it's the bedrock. I don't know which image you want to use. But he so frequently is working with the chorale. His cantatas, not exclusively, but to a great, great degree, are always based on Lutheran chorales. Not every stanza of a chorale and not every movement of a cantata is the chorale. But, for example, almost all of the opening movements of Bach cantatas are based on chorales, and it always concludes with a stanza from a Bach chorale, from a Lutheran chorale as well. So in that regard, he stands very squarely in the tradition that already Luther has launched with the writing of these first hymns that sort of provided a model for future hymn writers within the church. But at the time of Bach especially, there's sort of been a new movement afoot. Some of his predecessors had been writing music that was taking biblical texts and setting them in a way in order to let that text really shine forth so that one had a fuller understanding of the meaning of that text. And what Bach does is kind of bring these two traditions together in a sense, in which you have a combination of chorale texts, and you also then have these freely written texts, sometimes biblical quotations, but also quite often just free texts that are written by poets. And they would actually write sort of like a cycle of a whole set of poems that would be all sort of on one related theme that were fitting for a particular Sunday of the year, for example. They would match in many ways and complement the readings for a particular Sunday. And Bach took these cantata librettos and began to write multi-movement works for them. Now, the text, just to talk of a second, you have the Lutheran chorales, and very often, of course, the very objective means or the focus upon the objective work of Christ for our salvation. I mean, that's sort of a classic text that he's working with in terms of the chorales. But then the other texts, which comment on those chorales and upon the theological content of a particular day, what's unique about them is that very often they're in very emotive language, a very picturesque and graphic language. And so you'll get texts that are talking in great detail about the suffering of Christ, the pain, the anguish, the agony that he's bearing, the distress of the soul at a time of tribulation and temptation. So texts that are quite effusive with emotion, but at the same time texts that ultimately keep drawing us back to Christ, his righteousness, that is covering our sin. It doesn't wallow in the sinner's troubles and in the sinner's internal feelings to an extent that Christ gets lost, but rather it always keeps coming back to him. And so that becomes, I think, a central feature of those texts, which are very important. And why it's useful for us to take note of that is the fact that in our own day, I mean, things have really shifted in the direction not only just of emotive texts, but texts that really focus on the individual solely, and seldom get around to, you know, the objective work of Christ for us. So it becomes nothing but Christ in us and no Christ for us in terms of a theological emphasis. What that's led to in our own day, I fear, often has been the case that, you know, this subjectivity of texts for the sake of just focusing on the individual has caused many to say, well, that's bad. I shouldn't do anything, have anything to do with things that are subjective. We'll just work with the objective means and objective presentation of Christ and his work and not talk about we'll shy away from things that would in any way, bring up this subjectivity. Bach's music demonstrates for us in a very helpful way that there's the proper place for both. And it's not that he's coming up with this, something on his own, but this is just part of the Lutheran tradition that he grew out of. I mean, the 17th century we know is the age of orthodoxy, this, grand time of sort of taking the teachings of Luther and others and systematizing them in this very grand fashion that goes through every doctrine in super detail. Some have tried to portray that as a very cold era where we're not interested in people and their feelings, but at the very same time, the Lutheran Church in the 17th century had a rich piety that was also given expression. And so Bach's music in many ways kind of brings those two together and keeps them together rather than allowing them to be separated.
So then with about 30 seconds here, summing all of this up, do we have an idea, can we take a good educated guess on how Bach would do among us today? About 30 seconds, Dr. Grimm.
Yeah, we can only speculate to some degree, but I do think this, if he were the same man working in our era, he would be bold, he would not be timid or apologetic for what he was doing, he would stretch our ears in ways we're not used to perhaps. He would probably make mistakes at times, but I think my goal with the article was to try to help to say to the church, that we don't just listen to Bach's music for its own sake, but recognize that what he taught us is that in our own age, we need to encourage musicians to be faithful, to be knowledgeable about the church's past, the rich tradition we've been given, but then to take all that and to do their work and to do it well and do it boldly, so that the church in our own age can benefit from these new gifts God has given, because those composers are gifts God gives to his church now. And to the degree we can encourage them to hone their craft, to be the very best they can be, to learn from the past, and then to bring those treasures to the people now, it will benefit the church.
Dr. Paul Grimm is Associate Professor of Pastoral Ministry and Missions and Dean of the Chapel at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of an article in the latest Concordia Theological Quarterly titled, What Would Bach Do Today? Dr. Grimm, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thanks very much. Appreciate the time.